Session number 26947.
Jarvis, Real 7. We're talking about Operation Varsity on the 24th of March 1945, and you just had a delayed takeoff. Now, could you explain the importance of the position in the stream? Because obviously you weren't where you should have been. You were meant to be, what, 5th or 6th, I think you said.
That's right.
And now, of course, you were last.
Absolutely.
What importance did that have?
Well, the importance was that E Squadron, they were given certain targets that they'd had to take their troops to. And the ones which I were taking over was part of two or three gliders, the troops in which were to capture a Hemmingham railway station and also to help with the capture of the three bridges over the River Isle.
And you, why did you have to be in a certain place in the flying stream?
Because we were going down with troops and associated troops together as a group. And which were due to land by Hemmingham Railway Station. Now, the people at the further down the stream, with the 60 combinations up to the back, they were given different different targets. So, therefore, if I arrived at the target area, I would be going down by myself because all the rest of them had gone down ahead of me, and I would be in a very vulnerable position.
So what did you decide to do about this?
Well, it was Alex Bly's idea. He chatted to me on the intercom and said, well, I realised, Stan, he said, I can't join the stream ahead of us because you would be in the wrong place. And so he said, what I'll do with my navigator, we'll work out an alternative course to try to get you back into the stream at the position fairly near to where you were due to be originally. And I was obviously very grateful. So the navigator worked out a dogleg course, and then we then flew towards the continent and over the continent for almost 3 hours in splendid isolation, not seeing another aircraft. And some 3 hours later...
Now, anything happened during that flight? Anything at all? Or was it just 3 hours of sitting?
Just 3 hours of sitting, that's all. Just following the tug behind us, obviously at the end of the rope, that's all.
Did you have any work to do?
I mean, none at all, none.
In those circumstances, did you have any flying to do? Or did you
We were literally had to fly, keep the aircraft in the high tow above the tow aircraft. And he was the one who was aiming for the Rhine to get to a certain place at a certain time.
So for you, that was quite easy, just to keep it in the high tow position?
That's all, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
So no sight of any, no Germans, no British, no nothing?
Nothing, no. We were amazed. We thought we would be attacked by German fighters on the way over, as we had no protection at all. But in the event, we were very, very fortunate. We never saw another aeroplane the whole time.
What happened when you reached the Rhine area?
Well, say, getting on for 3 hours later, we were approaching the Rhine, and suddenly we saw the armada of aircraft ahead of us stretching from horizon to horizon. It was a fantastic sight. And we slowly got closer and closer. And when we eventually merged into the actual stream, I could see by the registration numbers on the tugs and the gliders that I was no more than 4 or 5 gliders away from the position which I held originally, and I thought that was remarkable.
In your notes, you mentioned that it was very obvious that they'd been through some flak. Now, was that flak that was happening over the Rhine? Or tell us about that.
Well, when we joined the stream, then we were then getting closer and closer to the Rhine. And at that stage, anti-aircraft fire was opening up, and you could see black puffs in the distance. And obviously, it was quite thick and numerous, and also tracer fire was going up, but we were going towards the Rhine, and as we approached it, several of the tug aircraft came by. Some were badly damaged, some were on fire, And obviously by gunfire that they had been over the landing zone. And it certainly wasn't much of a welcome for those of us who were going in to stay.
So what happened next then? I mean,
well, we were coming up to the Rhine, to our horror, we found that the whole area was covered with gun smoke, and smoke which had been artificially laid down to protect the troops who were going the Rhine across the Rhine by amphibious tanks and boats, etc. Now, we were amazed to see this smoke because it was fairly evident it was not taken into consideration by the military authorities that the glider pilots would need to see the ground when they got to the landing zones. And that is what actually happened. We then flew on over the Rhine, barely saw it. It was just a faint outline of water. And then 7 or 8 miles east of the Rhine, Alex Blythe said to me, "Stan, we're coming up to the LZ now."
Now, was there still a problem with smoke?
Oh, yes, it was still extended way over in an easterly direction, very close to the town of Wesel, which had been heavily bombed by Bomber Command the night before. In fact, it had been demolished. And
so the problem was that you couldn't see to judge your landing. That's
absolutely, we didn't
it.
Know. I had to take it from Alex Blythe that we were over the landing area. We were technically in cloud, but obviously it was smoke. We couldn't see the ground at all. And we had to take their word that we're over the landing zone. So at that stage, I had no alternative but to pull the lever, release the glider, and we went down in the smoke.
Now, before that, even you said that some of the gliders were hit. Could you describe? And you said, you know, they were broken.
Well, as we cast off from the tug aircraft, the anti-aircraft fire was coming in thick and fast, and several of the gliders went down in flames, quite like torches. Others were breaking up in midair, which was a quite horrific sight, as you might imagine. And very, very frightening, to be perfectly frank. But we carried on, obviously then got lower and lower because we're now not being pulled by the tug. And the main thing that we had to do as pilots to try to establish our position as quickly as possible. And Peter Geddes, my co-pilot, he was looking around, making sure that no other gliders would come near us. If so, he would warn me and we'd steer away. But also looking around to see anything that emerged through the smoke.
Landmarks, in other words.
Absolutely.
And you couldn't see anything?
Not at all, no. No. And well, when we got down to about 1,500 feet, I think it was there, about that height, suddenly he saw an autobahn in the distance. And that was obviously a major landmark. And we realised that it was east of Hamminkeln railway station. And then slowly things become clearer. And the trees, a line of trees alongside the railway station and the railway lines and the buildings became clearer and clearer. And one of three fields that had been given to landing, they were all as we saw on the briefing photographs. And I knew exactly where I was. But at that stage, there was a tremendous crash on the starboard side, and I had about 4 feet of the starboard wing and most of the aileron blown away by anti-aircraft fire, and tracers were coming in thick and fast.
What effect did that have, the loss of 4 feet of the starboard?
Practically turned the glider on its back. So I had to struggle very quickly to restabilise the glider, and with the help of Peter, my second pilot, we managed to pull it back onto a straight and level attitude.
How did you do that?
By the control column and the rudder bars. It just purely by, you know, flying skill.
What would you do? I mean, if you've got no controls on one wing, what would you
well,
do?
Well, I hadn't lost complete control. I mean, I had the aileron and port wing, and I had the rudder and the elevators, and you could use those
to stop it.
Well, by using your feet. Using your feet and using your hands, turning the steering column wheel, and you're able to get sufficient control back.
What I meant was technically, how did you do it? I mean, not that, you know, I mean, what did you do?
Well, having stabilised the aircraft, I then realised I had to get down as quickly as possible. So I put lowered the flaps, which are huge things like barn doors, and went into a very steep dive. And the anti-aircraft fire was getting much more accurate, and tracer bullets and incendiary bullets were streaming past. Fortunately, I wasn't hit by them, but they were very, very close. And then I went there, kept going down till about 50 feet from the ground, and then pulled it out of the dive, and then slowly let the aircraft sink down to ground level. And as we flew across the fields, we managed to collide with some post and wire fences that German farmers used to segregate the fields. And in actual fact, it did help to slow the glider down. And we were going quite fast across these fields, but only a few feet above the ground, and we were followed down the field by a stream of incendiary and tracer bullets. And then I gently let the glider sink onto the ground, onto its wheels, and then we converged towards this line of trees, because the troops wished to get as close to the station as possible. And then I applied what brakes was necessary, slew the glider out round, and eventually came to a rest about 20 feet away from the railway fence.
Now, how close was this? I mean, was this a good achievement, or was it just average?
Well, it was extremely close, because the troops wished for me to get the closer as they can, so they didn't have to be exposed running across open ground naturally. Now, at that stage, when the glider came to rest, the troops leapt out of the glider and formed a circle and decided what they were going to do next. And some of us were in a ditch alongside the railway fence. And a little bit of a humour arose in the seriousness of the war, because I was lying beside one of the airborne troops, and he said to me, when we left RAF Birch, we were chatting to you, we asked you to get as close as possible to the railway station so we weren't exposed running across open ground. But if you'd been any closer, we'd have been in the booking office. So I said, well, that's compliments to the RAF. And we had a little laugh in the seriousness of war.
Now, what about the disembarkation? What state were the troops in, and how did they get out?
Well, they rushed out very, very quickly, and they demonstrated to me what highly professional training they'd had. They knew their job, and I was full of admiration, candidly, for what they did. And they not least of all looked after Peter Geddes and myself, because they realised we weren't soldiers.
So what did they do when they landed? They jumped out, and then what did they do?
Well, the sergeant and the officers chatted to the men, and they said they decided that they were going to proceed to the station, capture it with other troops that were landing nearby. Then afterwards, they would move over, well, about 200 or 300 yards away, east of the station, to the River Issel, where bridges had to be captured in addition to the station.
Now, was there any opposition to the capture of the station? Any Germans?
Yes. Well, what was unexpected is that while we were laying in this ditch, and also the surrounding area and behind piles of timber, suddenly a group of German troops approached from the direction of the River Issel down the road, and they were accompanied by a light armoured vehicle. A strange it may seem, it didn't have camouflage. It was it seemed to have desert colours, and that was quite strange. But they attacked the troops with me, and a tremendous firefight broke out for 2 or 3 minutes.
Now, did you take part in this?
No, I only had, remember, I had a Browning pistol, and we had with us, we were carrying this pit and these bombs, but we weren't expert in them. And a sergeant, during the course of the firefight, he took them from us, and he primed the pit, prepared the bomb, and took aim and fired at this armoured vehicle. Well, what happened was that it didn't hit the armoured vehicle, but it landed alongside it with a tremendous crash. And I think it probably frightened the life out of the German crew, because they immediately lost interest in us, and they swung round and then went backwards along the road back towards the River Isel. And the accompanying infantry troops then withdrew at the same time.
Now, the only thing I want to make clear is, because I asked you whether there were any Germans defending the railway station, you didn't really answer. It sounds like the words that they captured the railway station and then these Germans appeared.
That is correct.
Right?
That
so
is
the,
correct.
The railway station was just taken.
It was taken. The only German troops that were at the station were anti-aircraft nests of guns.
Now, what happened to them?
Well, they were several had been captured by paratroops that had landed beforehand and neutralised them. Yeah.
So it was essentially an open target for that thing.
At that moment, it was.
Then these Germans. So what? And what were you doing? I mean, you were basically just not hiding. That sounds terrible. You were just
keeping your heads down.
Taking cover.
We were indeed, because we weren't soldiers. But the Germans didn't respect the fact that we're pilots. They shot at anything that moved. Quite rightly, as well. That was their job.
Now, there was a case where it looks like a civilian came.
Yes.
Well, he was in civilian clothes. And I didn't quite understand that story it was a newspaper report.
That's right. Well, we suddenly were aware, while we were laying in this ditch, that a figure in a brown leather jacket was running across the field towards us with his hands in the air. He was ashen white, obviously terrified, and it was obviously he thought he was going to be killed because he was in civilian clothes and the Germans would be quite entitled to shoot him, in a battle situation. But when he joined us and realised that we weren't German troops, that we were British troops, obviously he was highly relieved. And he told us that he was a newspaper reporter that had just bailed out of a C-46 transport aircraft which was on fire. And he had no weapons with him. All he had with him was a notepaper and a pencil. And he was extremely pleased when he joined up with us. And apparently he stayed with the troops for some time afterwards.
So after the initial period, the troops were meant to advance towards the river
Isel. That's right. They did.
And they did that.
They did that. Yes, sir. That's right.
And did you see anything of their advance?
No, because at that particular time, when they had captured the railway station and this firefight was over, at that stage, Peter Gadsden and I, we had to leave the troops because our job was complete. And we then, by pre-arrangement, had to work our way along the railway track towards a rendezvous point, which was about 300 or 400 yards up the railway line. And we managed to do that fairly successfully.
Do you remember anything about that trip? You were going back to a farmhouse, weren't
you?
That's
right.
Anything about that?
Just before we got to the point that we had to leave the railway lines, we were running across a cobbled station yard between a couple of warehouses, and it's fairly obvious that we were spotted by German troops because they fired at us with heavy caliber guns, and the bullets were bouncing off the cobbles like sparks or fireworks, and obviously quite frightening. So we dived into a German lavatory, which is part of the railway facilities, which was quite questionable with regard to the hygiene standard. In fact, it was awful.
Then we
moved on and left the railway track and then ran across an open field until we got to this farmhouse where the other Garuda pilots were assembling.
Now, how far away was this farmhouse? It says here 150 yards west of the railway station. Now,
that's about right. It's about 150 yards, yes.
And what was happening at the farmyard?
Well, that was an area that had been designated for collecting prisoners and assembling them, because they realised a lot of the German troops would be captured during the course of the landing, and not least of those that were manning anti-aircraft pits.
Now, was this farmhouse part of the village of Hamminkeln, or is it in the direction of it? Is it nearer the village?
Well, I would say it was about a mile away from the village of Hamminkeln.
So, right. So what happened then with these German prisoners? Were any there when you got there?
Oh, yeah, there were quite a lot there that had been assembled. And the pilots then were coming in, and there were casualties who were being treated, laying around. And it was like a mini headquarters, but for the purpose of dealing with prisoners.
Now, how many troops were there?
Quite a lot of British troops. There were quite a lot, yeah.
Had all the pilots gone there?
Well, they were still streaming in from the gliders. Where they'd landed. Obviously, they'd landed over a fairly wide area.
Now, one of the things you were doing was you were told to search the prisoners.
That's right. I was given instruction.
Tell us about that whole story, because there's some quite funny bits, but there's also, you know, the interest of what they were. Tell us about it.
Well, I was allocated the duty of searching German prisoners with another pilot. It wasn't Peter Geddes. It was another pilot who had a Sten gun. And we were told to go into a room. It was about 25 foot square, and there were German troops all the way around the room, facing the wall with their hands in the air. And I was told to search them and to remove from them any intelligence material, maps, weapons, money, various things that I thought was necessary to be confiscated. But personal things like photographs and letters, they were then put back in the pockets of the German soldiers. And I was to do this, and any goods that were confiscated, I was given a small table to put those goods on. And to try to, as quickly as possible, search all these prisoners. Well, I started off, and I turned each one round individually, and then went for their, undid their chromium buttons, went through their various pockets, looked at the contents, confiscated those which I think were necessary, put them on the table, and then those which were of a personal nature put back in their pockets, did up their buttons, turned them around, and then moved on to the next one. Now, this went on for a little while, probably about five or six different German soldiers.
What state were they in?
They were very, very quiet and very relaxed. I got the impression that there was a sense of euphoria with them, because they realised their war was over and they weren't going to be killed, and so they knew the war wouldn't be long before it'd be finished.
So they weren't scared or
aggressive. Oh,
or
no,
aggressive.
Not at all.
They were
just quietly doing what they were told
and delighted, basically.
I got that impression. They were quite cooperative. They didn't object to what I was doing. But after a while, I suddenly realised that amongst all the material which I was confiscating, there was a huge amount of money, Dutch guilders. And I'm talking about thousands and thousands of them by denomination, bundles of them, I was removing from the tunic pockets of these soldiers. And eventually, a curiosity overcame me, and I thought, well, I've got to find out where this money came from. So I said to the room generally, do any of you people speak English? And one German soldier over said, yes, I do. Another one said, yes, I do. I said, where did you get this money from? Well, one looked at the other one a bit sheepishly, and he said, well, our unit was withdrawn across the Rhine a few weeks ago, and apparently they'd done a Dutch bank before they came over, and they still had the money with them, which I thought was quite curious.
And there's a couple. There's another. There's an even funnier. Well, there's a funny story as well. That I
hope yes. It's a little bit of light relief. I say again, in the series of war, I was gradually working my way around the room, and I came across a young German soldier, probably about my age, or a little bit younger. And I put my hand in his left-hand top tunic pocket and undid the button, put my hand in, and came out with a handful of condoms. And, of course, I was taken aback a bit, stuffed them back in his pocket, did the button up, and turned round to his English-speaking comrade and said to him, "You can tell your friend here where he's going. It's going to be a long time before he can use those, being obviously been a prisoner of war." And when that explained to him in German, all the rest of the German troops roared with laughter. Well, I didn't think it was that funny, but I think it indicated the sense of euphoria that they had. They thought it was really funny.
How long were you doing this?
Probably about an hour or so, yes.
And then you seem to have had a large number of them.
There were quite a lot to do, yeah.
So what happened next?
Well, once the number got quite high, it was decided they were then going to be taken to Hemmingkeln, to an area where a lot more German troops were being assembled. And so a small group of glider pilots, army and RAF, were assembled, and we marched all these German troops to Hemmingkeln. I say it's about a mile away, and then deposited them with another group of airborne troops. They were the Devons, in actual fact. And Peter and I, we then made our way back.
Hang on. Now, there's actually a picture taken of this time, which has you in it, which I hope we'll get a copy for. I think we've probably already given to the War Museum, yes. It's BU...
2303.
Oh, it's an original War Museum picture. And this very clearly, and it's actually got a cross on where you are. You're one of the guards.
That's right.
Marching
That's right.
along, looking very young, actually.
Yes.
There are quite a number of German prisoners there. There's about 40 or 50 with you, and then you can see another batch behind them.
Yes, well, it's just a handful of glider pilots who were actually in charge of them.
But you're emphasising there's no resistance or attempt to escape from any of these men.
None whatsoever. They were quite happy, yeah.
Now, was it's Hemmingkeln, isn't it?
That's right.
Was there was it empty, deserted? I mean, it looks pretty deserted. Was there anyone there?
No. The civilians, in actual fact, had been taken to Hemmingkeln Church and for protection, really. And there were no civilians about at all, no.
Now, the next phase is, it seems to be about 6 o'clock, 1800 hours, you were given a defensive role.
That's right.
Is that the next thing that happened? So that basically all the rest of it's filled that time. They're going to the farmhouse, and the rest of it. That's filled the rest of the time.
Well, we marched back, the glider pilots, back to the rendezvous point. After we deposited the prisoners, and we managed to see some of the sites, sites at the site of damaged gliders, and they were quite appalling in actual fact.
Can you tell us, I don't want to upset you, but can you tell us a bit about what you saw?
Well, one in particular, we saw the glider crash while we were laying in this ditch with our airborne troops, and he came over very fast, about 50 foot high, and slammed into a farmhouse about 100 yards away from us with an almighty crash. When we came back from Hemmingkeln, Peter and I went over to the site, and it transpired that it was a Jeep and a 25-pounder gun with a crew of about six and the two pilots. And they were all killed. They were laying around in various conditions. But what I thought was quite appalling, that the two pilots were still in their cockpits and they were wearing airborne helmets, but the Jeeper and the gun smashed into them against the farmhouse wall, and their heads were no more than about 2 inches wide. They had been crushed. It was a terrible sight, as you might imagine, both of them, yeah.
Now, One thing I haven't asked, I'm sure it's a matter of record, but do you know what time the actual landing was? I should have asked you earlier. Do you know?
Yes, we actually landed about 10 past 10.
10 past
10? 10 past 10, that's right, yes.
So 10:10.
That's
in
right.
The morning, so
yes.
Late morning.
That's
or
right.
Morning.
And it's a matter of interest. Can I come? Yeah. It's a matter of interest that one of the German soldiers that I was speaking to, who spoke English quite perfectly, he rather impudently said to me, "You were late, weren't you?" And I said to him, "What do you mean we were late?" He said, "Well, we expected you at 10 o'clock and you arrived at 10 past." Now, I thought to myself, so much for security. They knew exactly when we were coming and they were well armed and waiting for us.